Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 11 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
Well, today, Steve, we're going to discuss two of the greatest mysteries in astronomy, and those are, of course, dark energy and dark matter. In previous episodes, we've talked about how energy and matter are equivalent, but there's a twist with today's topic. Admittedly for us, this is a very deep and mysterious delve into astrophysics. So as we often do on Space Talks, we've got to be transparent in that we don't have the answers, but research prominent authorities on a weekly basis and then try to use a rather well-understood analogy to help clarify matters.
And as you said, Tim, we must hasten from the outset to state that, like all analogies, it's not going to be truly accurate. For today, let's start with a reference to the classic detective board game Clue. Now, from the outset of the game, you know the solution of who did it, where they did it, and how is in a sealed brown envelope in the center of the board. Our conundrum today is, when you open the answer envelope, it's revealed that the perpetrator is someone not in the game, and that's impossible. And that's kind of how it is with these two mysterious characters, dark matter and dark energy.
Well, that's an intriguing way to start, Steve, but as we often do, let's see if I've got an update for you that you'll enjoy. It's about taking a minute or two to talk about the James Webb Telescope. Now, obviously, in the last few weeks, we've mentioned that quite a bit. We've compared the new telescope with the old Hubble Telescope, and we've actually been making reference to the new initiative, a new work from the Webb Telescope in conversations about the origins of the universe. And there are some really great opportunities now. So if your travels, perhaps during the holiday season, take you to a city like Vancouver or Victoria, you could go to the IMAX Theater in each of those cities and catch Deep Sky. It's a spectacular production. It looks at the development of that telescope. And of course, there's lots of the very first images that have been captured, and I've seen it myself, but I actually found it quite moving. So that's hopefully something that you can put on your list of things to consider. But there's also lots of possibilities online. The largest collection of images from the Webb Telescope would be on the NASA website. But you can search for more curated collections on places like Popular Mechanics, the CBC website, or the website that's operated by the Canadian Space Agency.
Well, thanks for that, Tim. And now back to the topic at hand. Since we're talking about dark energy and dark matter, let's start with the adjective dark. Normally, we ascribe dark to those things which are not light in color, such as the afternoon clouds look dark.
Well, not only that, Steve, but the word dark can also be used in a literary parlance to describe, a person's character or thoughts, such as, you know, dark thoughts entered the criminal's mind as he pondered the route of the Brinks truck.
That's kind of what is meant normally when we say dark. And now let's expand our thinking. In astronomical terms, dark often describes something which doesn't emit, absorb, or reflect electromagnetic radiation, particularly visible light. Now, with regard to those cosmic entities, which I'm sure listeners have heard before called dark nebulae, these are dense interstellar clouds of gas and dust blocking light from background stars. Here on Earth, they're often seen as dark patches against a brighter cosmic background.
So these interstellar gas clouds are between us and bright background stars, and the backlighting makes them dark. It's like taking a photograph of someone with their back to the sun, which you're facing. The picture ends up with a nice bright background, but your friend's face, well, it's in the dark. And to clarify the word nebula, I'm sure we've all heard that phrase, the Greeks have a word for everything. But with regard to the word nebulae, the plural of nebula, it's actually derived from the Latin word for something unsure or fuzzy. Therefore, the famous Horsehead Nebula literally means a dark patch of dust and cloud which resembles a horse's head.
So far, so good, Tim. And today we're going to be discussing two other dark items, as you mentioned, dark matter and dark energy. Now, I fully realize we're going to be going out on a precarious limb trying to describe these phenomena, as new observations and hypotheses are being revised from recent data from new space probes such as you mentioned, the James Webb Space Telescope. But here we go. At this point in time, cosmologists speak of dark matter as being something which doesn't emit, absorb, or reflect light, making it invisible to electromagnetic radiation.
You know, Steve, in this case, it sounds like we're talking about a cosmological poltergeist. But scientists working with the known laws of the universe observed objects weren't moving in a manner that was consistent with the laws that we do have. So something was either missing or something was wrong.
Dark matter was theorized almost 100 years ago in the 1930s, and dark energy was theorized in 1998. In recent decades, it's been calculated that all of what we are, all of what we see, all of what humanity has built, and all the stars and galaxies only account for roughly 5% of the mass of the universe. What about the other 95%? Well, it appears that dark matter accounts for 25% of that, and dark energy accounts for the other 70%.
Okay, so now I understand why a new generation of scientists wants to solve this puzzle, and even for no other reason than to have that venerable academic phrase come into mind, publish or perish. However, we too, with a mere great interest in science, are going to try to explain to listeners what this unknown 95% is. That's one tall matter, especially as cosmologists and astrophysicists can't detect it, yet they postulate it must exist. That's sort of like someone saying to us, there's an elephant in the room, but you can't see it, feel it, smell it, or touch it, taste it, but it's your job to go find it. And here I was thinking the reference to that clue game was going to be just a big puzzle.
Well, dark matter's presence is inferred by its gravitational effects on visible matter, such as galaxies and galactic clusters. Something is causing large-scale entities, such as whole galaxies, to move in an unpredictable manner. But as you said, we can't detect what it is. And so cosmologists call this something dark matter. And referring back to the elephant in the room analogy, it's like finding a huge pile of dung in the corner, but you can't see what created it.
Love the analogy and what an image that creates. Now, I've done a bit of research on this topic and found there are a number of reasons for there being dark matter. And the first is, as you mentioned, the otherwise inexplicable movement of galaxies. The rotational curves of stars and such at the outer regions of galaxies are moving faster than should be expected based on the galaxy's visible mass. And just as mud flies off a speeding car or a bicycle wheel, these fast-moving stars at the edge of swirling galaxies should be flung away from the center, but they're not. Something is keeping them in place. If only the visible matter were considered, the rotational values of the outer stars would sharply drop off with increasing distances from the galactic center. However, that's not the case, and so that suggests the presence of additional unseen mass either somewhere or throughout the entire galaxies, and that unknown item is deemed to be the so-called dark matter.
Additionally, the motion of entire galaxies themselves within local clusters of galaxies also implies the existence of dark matter. And by the way, our Milky Way galaxy belongs to such a local cluster. And back in the day when I took a university course on this, it was believed that there were 17 galaxies in our local group. With better instrumentation, our local group is now thought to be comprised of 40 galaxies spread over a diameter of 10 million light years. And when calculating the visible mass of ours and other galactic clusters, cosmologists note there's insufficient mass to account for them binding together. Now, let's try to simplify things here by using another analogy. It's sort of like adding a single drop of glue between two speeding bowling balls and expecting them to stick together. Something, like unseen dark matter, is sought to provide the additional mass and subsequent gravity necessary to hold the cluster together.
Well, here's a second reason, Steve, for inferring that there must be dark matter. Listeners may be aware of a phenomenon known as gravitational lensing, which we've previously mentioned. This was predicted by Einstein back in 1915 in his general theory of relativity. He theorized that gravity is not only a force between masses, but also a curvature, or rather a curvature of space-time caused by the presence of mass and energy, and that the curvature of space-time can bend light as it travels through a gravitational field.
We know that various mediums such as water and glass prisms do bend light, But Einstein's theory wasn't accepted until 4 years later during the May 29th, 1919 solar eclipse. British astrophysicist and astronomer Sir Arthur Eddington led an expedition to Principe Island off the west coast of Africa and another team to Sobral, Brazil. Eddington and his teams took advantage of the solar eclipse to observe stars that were situated close to the sun in the sky, making their light more susceptible to gravitational deflections. The success of that 1919 eclipse and the light-bending observations remains one of the most famous and celebrated experimental confirmations of a scientific theory in history.
So curved space-time does indeed bend light, and we observe the light from galaxies being bent. But in many other cases, we can't see what's causing the light to bend. Therefore, something pervasively massive and yet unseen in space must be causing that bending. And that something is referred to, once again, dark matter. A third reason for inferring the existence of dark matter is the large-scale distribution of galaxies and of the universe, which can be explained more accurately if the presence of dark matter is taken into account. Computer simulations have been used which incorporate dark matter as a significant component, and they align more closely with the observed large-scale structure of the cosmos.
Now, referring back to our unseen elephant metaphor, you're going to tell me that this massive invisible beast is barging about in a room, pushing the walls back and forth, causing them to move. You know, that suddenly reminds me of a poem I learned way back in grade 5 while living in Manitoba. That poem was entitled, "Who Has Seen the Wind?" Little did I know, back in the 1950s, that little Stephen Lowry would decades later recall and use the poem. So let's have a listen.
Who has seen the wind? Neither I nor you. But when the leaves hang trembling, the wind is passing through. Who has seen the wind? Neither you nor I. But when the trees bow down their heads, the wind is passing by.
Going from earthly observations of unseen forces in today's episode, we're faced with similar unseen cosmic forces, and I quite like the following viewpoint from the noted astrophysicist Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. In particular, I like his summation of dark matter and how we might as well have named it.
So dark matter is just simply what we call this thing about which we know nothing, responsible for 85% of the gravity of the cosmos. We've known about dark matter since the 1930s. Back then it was called missing mass. That's what it was called. Because, there's got to be some mass. Where is it? We can't find it. It's got to be here somewhere because we got the gravity. If you have the gravity, you got to have the mass. Mass and gravity go together. It's really dark gravity. Actually, we shouldn't call it anything. We should call it Fred, something that has no meaning because we don't know what it is.
Well done, Tim. And so we don't know what dark matter is, but I found an interesting clip from cosmologist Dr. Paul Sutter about what dark matter isn't. And as a matter of fact, he's written a book on this subject entitled Your Place in the Universe. I recently read this book, but researching today's episode has spurred me to having another perusal of it to try to gain further insights and a better understanding.
Okay, Steve, you put that library book on hold. Let's again refer to that metaphorical elephant in the room. In the metaphor, we believe there's a big, invisible, undetectable creature in the room, and we're guessing what it might be. Similarly, in science, cosmologists try to narrow the search by eliminating what dark matter can't be. And as you said, one such scientist is Dr. Paul Sutter. Let's have a listen and stretch our minds.
The luminous material in our universe, the stars and galaxies, tell us that dark matter exists, but it doesn't tell us what it's made of. We do know what it isn't. It's not just normal matter that happens to be dim and hard to see, like rocks or planets or black holes. We know this because we've made measurements of the very early universe that tell us how much normal matter is in the universe, and there simply isn't enough to account for all the gravitational effects. Instead, dark matter has to be cold and collisionless. Cold means that the dark matter moves slowly compared to the speed of light. And collisionless means that it doesn't interact with itself or normal matter. That means dark matter is everywhere. Dark matter particles are streaming through this room right now. We are swimming in an ocean of dark matter particles. But because the dark matter doesn't interact with normal matter, we can't directly detect it. We can only learn about it through indirect methods.
It seems that we can only learn of dark matter through indirect methods, just as we can only discover the characteristics of our invisible elephant in the room through indirect methods. And this quite reminds me of the centuries-old parable of the six blind men who happen to come across an elephant and their subsequent attempts to describe it. The first blind man stumbles across a solid elephant and deems it like a wall. The second feels its sharp tusk and thought it was like a spear. The third felt its trunk and declared it was like a snake, while a fourth felt the girth of its knee and thought it was like a tree. The fifth feels the shape of its ear and thinks it's like a fan, and the last one touches its long tail and declares it's just like a rope. They all expound their personal beliefs while berating the others, and though each was partially right, as a group, they were all wrong. In other words, disputants often argue about something they've never seen, and if we switch out the old blind men for current cosmologists, I think our analogy is nicely summed up.
You know, I'm reminded, of course, all too often about that phrase we use here, the more I know, the less I know. In the second half of the show, we're going to talk about dark energy. These are two mysteries that have been on the minds of a great many scientists, and the exploration is well underway. So now we're on to dark energy, which acquires its dark adjective because it doesn't emit light and doesn't appear to have mass, and yet somehow it's thought to be responsible for the observed acceleration of the universe. So let's start off with how dark energy was discovered. That happened in 1994 when astronomers made a groundbreaking observation of type 1A supernovae in distant galaxies. These special supernovae serve as a so-called standard candle, meaning they have a consistently intrinsic brightness. One supernova is as bright as the other.
You know, Tim, I've never really liked the term standard candle to describe a cosmic brightness level. Wouldn't you think in this day and age that something more modern, such as standard light bulb, if nothing else, would be used? Candles? Really? How 18th century? Let's hook up a horse and buggy and go for a hayride.
I couldn't agree with you more, Steve. But we didn't write the rule book, and science doesn't care what we think, so we are stuck with the term standard candle. So when astronomers looked at type 1A supernova, they observed their brightness, their distances from us could be determined, as could the light's redshift. And it was determined that they were increasingly accelerating as their distance from us increased. In the January 1998 press conference of the American Astronomical Society, the Supernova High Z Cosmology Project team, catch that name, made a stunning announcement. They had analyzed over 50 of these supernovae and found that the universe's size was not static and that expansion would continue forever, and that the expansion could be explained by a cosmological constant. But after the press conference, one astute reporter picked up on the incredible fact of accelerating expansion due to a mysterious force pushing the universe apart, while the rest simply reported that there could be no second big crunch. So there were three Nobel Prizes for Physics awarded in 2011 for this groundbreaking discovery.
Tim, I've got an audio clip of Dr. Sean Carroll offering a nice review of this finding. So let's have a listen to acquire a better understanding of dark energy.
We've known for a long time that the universe is expanding. If you look at distant galaxies, they're moving away from us. And the more distant galaxies are moving away faster. So really, it's not just an explosion of galaxies away from us. All galaxies are moving away from all the other galaxies. Space itself is getting bigger. But you'd expect that the expansion of the universe is something that would slow down. These galaxies have gravity. They attract each other. So you would expect the expansion of the universe to diminish with time. So it was a big surprise in 1998 when we realized that the galaxies are actually speeding up. If you look at one galaxy, not only is it moving away from us, but tomorrow it will be moving away from us faster. This is what we call the acceleration of the universe. But we're not completely baffled. We have a good theoretical model handed down to us by Einstein. The idea that even empty space has energy, what we call vacuum energy or dark energy. And this vacuum energy pushes space itself. It causes distant galaxies to move away from us faster and faster. That's where the acceleration comes from. So theoretical cosmologists are trying to understand what could be going on. Is it really vacuum energy? Is it some variation of that? Or is it even a modification of Einstein's general relativity, our theory of gravity? If vacuum energy is the right answer, the universe will continue to expand, galaxies will move away from us, and the universe will gradually become a lonelier, darker, emptier place.
Also in 1998, the esteemed cosmologist Dr. Michael Turner coined the term dark energy to describe this mysterious force. And Science magazine called the acceleration of the universe as being, quote, the breakthrough of the year in December 1998.
So prior to this 1998 announcement, it was assumed that the expansion of the universe, which occurred from the time of the Big Bang, would eventually slow down, halt, and reverse itself. But you know, Steve, there was uncertainty. I remember reading a book called The Physics of Immortality, I think it was, and there were different points of view as to whether the universe would keep expanding, remain static, or contract. But after all, if you quickly throw a ball up in the air, it begins to slow down, halt, and fall back due to gravity. Therefore, the expanding galaxies and their stars should do the same. It's going to contract, but that's not what is happening.
To clarify a term you used a few moments ago, we have to explain what high Z means in cosmological speak. All redshifts of varying degree are denoted by the letter Z, corresponding to the fractional change in wavelength. And by definition, the fastest acceleration possible is plus one.
So high Z means a very fast acceleration, but how do the standard candle measurements of the 50 supernovae come into play, Steve?
Remember that phase in your life when you and your pals played with flashlights and shone them at each other? Now, from a distance, the flashlight was merely a source of brightness, but up close, when you jammed the flashlight into their eyes, it was absolutely blinding. So if we use, let's say, a normal 800 lumen LED light bulb as a replacement for a standard candle supernova, if it's 1 kilometer away from you, it's probably producing something like only 10 lumens. And from that, you can calculate its distance. Additionally, if it's stationary, then there'll be no redshifting of the light emitted. However, if it's moving rapidly away, then the light will be redshifted.
So, using these astronomical terms, if it is moving slowly away, we will have a low Z of perhaps, 0.1. But if it's on a speeding jet, perhaps moving away from you, it would be a higher Z, perhaps, 0.3. With 1 itself, 1.0, being the absolute fastest value. So this being the case, the high Z value of some of the observed supernovae had an astounding value of 0.9, meaning they were accelerating away at incredibly fast speeds. This was a paradigm shift, as cosmologists expected that recession velocity would always be decelerating due to the gravitational attraction of the matter of the universe.
I've done a little bit of research and found the accelerated expansion of the universe is weirdly thought to have begun not at the beginning of time and the Big Bang, but when the universe entered its dark energy-dominated era roughly a mere 5 billion years ago. Now, since the universe is 13.8 billion years old, this means it was just chugging along, accelerating slowly for 8.8 billion years, and then suddenly something caused it to speed up. Something caused new space to be created and quicker than ever before.
And this is where the mysterious dark energy comes into play. An accelerated expansion can be accounted for by positive energy, and that's what cosmologists call lambda, and which was quickly dubbed dark energy. Should listeners be motivated to do their own personal research on dark energy, here's a bit of help. Cosmologists use the term lambda-CDM model, which sounds pretty complicated, but it's not when dissected. Lambda is the 11th letter of the Greek alphabet, and it stands for various things in specific branches of math and science. In cosmology, lambda is a value which stands for the cosmological constant, a term that was originally coined by Albert Einstein himself when he was determining factors required for a static universe, which, of course, neither expands nor contracts. Now, Einstein, he was dissatisfied with his own equations, which showed that gravity would cause the universe to eventually contract, and he decided to counter this possibility by adding a numerical value, the cosmological constant, which would push outward and oppose the inward pull of gravity.
To use a nice and easy mathematical analogy, Let's say you're given the equation 4 times lambda equals 12. Doing the math, you realize that lambda in this case must equal 3, because 4 times 3 equals 12. When Einstein was trying to figure out a numerical outward force to balance the inward pull of gravity, he derived a number, and that was given the name lambda.
So lambda, just a number, while the other term in that phrase is CDM, and it's an acronym which stands for cold dark matter. So listeners, if you're doing some personal research on dark energy and come across the phrase lambda-CDM model, that's just a fancy way of saying they're talking about a value of unknown and undetectable energy pushing apart cold dark matter, which also hasn't been detected.
Yes, and doesn't that create a mind full of strange thoughts? It does to me. As we near the end of today's episode, let's listen to an interview with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who offers a recap of dark energy with one hypothetical consequence of its existence.
Another strange thing happening in the universe has been spotted by the Hubble Space Telescope. The observations of very distant supernovae showed that, a long time ago, the universe was actually expanding more slowly than it is today. However, the expansion of the universe has not been slowing due to gravity, as everyone thought. It has been accelerating. No one expected this. No one knew how to explain it. But something was causing it.
Some mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space acting opposite the force of gravity, whatever it is, we call it dark energy. That's our placeholder term to describe what we observe, the acceleration of the universe. Nothing known will stop this. So there's been some concern that maybe space does not have the flexibility necessary to allow such rapid expansion, and might space tear in some way previously unimagined? And what does that even mean? Does the question even have validity?
So what we have in this episode of Space Talks is a bit of a surprise ending. When the numbers didn't add up, scientists hypothesized answers to reconcile with dark matter and dark energy.
The crux to science is not to prove, but to disprove theories. And Tim, as we speak, teams of astrophysicists around the world are trying to disprove the hypothesized numbers and characteristics of both dark energy and dark matter. That's how science works.
And also, Steve, that's just one reason why poor old radio hosts like us can't find the perfect metaphor to describe what and how dark matter and dark energy does. On the bright side, finding more evidence and more understanding is exactly what has become the number one goal of astrophysicists and cosmologists alike. Steve, this has been another mind-boggling episode, and once again, our mandate has been to present sufficient detail to cause a thinking person to ponder what's going on.
And as we've said before, if you're more confused now than you were at the beginning of the episode, then our goal has been achieved.
And with that parting thought, that's about all the time we have on this episode. And so this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long. And we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring might be.